A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. We like to think this is the best place to get a review of the weekend's football action. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and today we are truly blessed because one of my all-time favorite football writers, in my opinion, the second best in the history of the Times sports pages, George Culkin, will be joining us on the phone. He's written a piece into The Game about physios at Sunderland. I know when I put it like that, it sounds boring, but it's actually very, very good. We're also going to be maybe taking a gander at people moving to China, maybe a little bit of Rowett and Zola, which I don't fully understand, but my guests do. I am especially excited because joining us down the line from the idyllic hamlet of Rippenden, it's the outstanding, the very excellent Ollie Kay. In the studio is, once again, Julian Lawrence and James Scowcroft. We're going to start at the Etihad. Now, City and Arsenal, before we get into this, I'm going to make another heartfelt plea. I did this through Twitter last year. If anybody wants to contradict me or join in, please do. So we have Match of the Day on Saturday night. And then on Sunday night, some of us are used to watching Match of the Day 2. Some weeks when there's a big Monday night game, nope, no Match of the Day 2 for you. Why don't you go and wait till Monday, okay? This happened again last night because it's the Merseyside Derby on Monday night. And I want to say, this is just stupid. When I tweet this out, people are like, well, but it's the rights. The BBC don't have the rights to show it and blah, blah, blah. You know what? When you sell the contract, Premier League, just poke the BBC and remind them, hey, BBC, some weeks there's going to be really big Monday night games. And so why don't we work something out? Since you get 8 minutes of highlights of every game, why don't we just work something out so that you can do a shorter show on a Monday night and a slightly longer one? If you want to make it digital, put it on BBC 4 or whatever, that's fine too. Hide it behind the red button if you've got something else that's really important to show. Sometimes clever people do things I don't understand. Richard Scudamore in the Premier League, they're very clever at selling things and marketing their game very well. If somebody has a really good explanation as to why they haven't taken this into account or consideration, some of our friends in the Premier League press office, Dan Johnson, people like that, please feel free to let me know. On to the game now. So Arsenal take an early lead through Theo Walcott, and then they kind of throw it all away. Now, Julian, help me. So they take the lead, and I saw like, oh, look, they are sitting deeper. This is great. They're going to do to them what other clubs have done to City, most notably Leicester and Chelsea.
At the end of the first half, Arsenal are back in that game. They're dominating it, and there was room there for a second goal that would probably have killed it. And it's the problem. And I do think that physically, they couldn't exploit all that space in front of them that Leicester and Chelsea did.
What's
so
the
well.
Problem?
I don't know. I think physically there's an issue there. I mean, we'll talk about Mesut Ozil later, but I just... Alexis Sanchez is a machine, as we've said before. Physically, he never feels anything. The guy can run forever. He's like Forrest Gump. No problem. I think the others, physically, there's an issue there where maybe they can't repeat the effort. Maybe they just, I don't know, there's something. Maybe they've played too much. He hasn't rotated enough. I don't know. But it looked to me that physically, there was a time where they couldn't take all that space in front of them.
Sko, are you buying this? Arsenal are physically unprepared.
I don't think they could get to a tempo that Man City got to in the second half. I think Julian's right to that point. I think their ball retention needs to be a lot better.
So basically, when's the last time you said that? When's the last time we said that about Arsenal? Their ball retention is poor.
In the big games we're now talking.
No. But it's remarkable what you're saying. Because we don't normally associate Arsenal with giving the ball away.
No, but there's two. No, but there's many different types of possession, right? So when you play the lower league teams at home and you pass it and you have your 70% possession, but the key facts in possession and the top players can go into a game like a Man City away, give me the ball and I'll keep the ball and won't give it away. And if I do give it away, I still want the ball and I'll still pass ball. And for me, so many Arsenal players just went missing in the second half. When the going gets tough, I thought Man City up the gear. You know, I know Pep's come out and said, oh, we've been working on transition and this, that and the other, which I thought they were very, very good. But just Arsenal, just, you know, the top players that you expect to be a lot better.
Ollie, I don't just want to be negative and blame those who come up short, so let's give some credit. And maybe, again, you can help explain this because you live closer to Pep's house than any of us do. All these things of sort of intensity and fight back and whatever else that and directness that City supposedly don't have, they were all very evident in display in the second half. Is that a credit to Pep? I mean, is he actually not just a pretty passing guy, but maybe one of those sort of inspirational halftime speech type guys?
I think his teams have always tried to play with great intensity. I think that has never been, a regular criticism of them. It was a big improvement in that the intensity was there, and De Bruyne and Sané and Silva and Sterling and Touré were all on the ball a lot more. To me, it wasn't of the standard of what City were doing in the first couple of months of the season when they were on the crest of a wave. It didn't have to be because Arsenal didn't make them work that hard.
Well, to be fair,
really, really nice goals.
It couldn't have been, right? Because, I mean, there's no Aguero, there's no Gundogan, there's no Fernandinho. Mm. When I looked at that with Fernando and Yaya Toure, I love Yaya, but you can't press when Yaya is in there.
No.
And Fernando, I think, is kind of like a right back playing in central midfield, right? He's not going to and especially when Arsenal seem to sort of be neat and tidy and 10 guys behind the ball, Pep necessarily had to find a different solution, I thought. And surely that's a credit to him, no?
Yeah, it is. I mean, they moved the front three around in the second half, and I thought they got Sané and Sterling in much better positions, and De Bruyne able to influence things a lot more, Silva able to influence things a lot more. It was a vastly improved performance, but as I said, I don't think it was of the level that City were producing earlier in the season. I don't think it had to be. I think Arsenal were unable to cope with a City team which found third gear, and they didn't have to hit the heights that they would and will expect to hit over the rest of the season.
I want to move it on to what was a bit of a mystery to me. Those of us who are Pep Guardiola fans, we're left, again, I like to think of this not as criticism, but sort of staring in wonder and failing to understand things. I don't understand the dropping of John Stones, and I certainly don't understand his reasons for it. I'm going to read this quote here from Paul Hurst's piece. He says, "I just apologize to John because he doesn't deserve to be out." It's obviously the second straight game that he's out. "I love him a lot. He's a really nice guy and he is good. But I just tried to do the same back four we played against Watford. Bakary Sagna also deserves to play. He's the nicest person I've ever met." I met Bakary Sagna too. He's a super nice guy. I don't know if he's the nicest person I have ever met in my lifetime, but maybe I've met nicer people than Pep has. And then he goes back and says, "I decided to play the same back four." Okay, I get it, right? But Ollie, I appreciate principles, ideas of cohesion and whatever else, but surely notions of quality and tactics come into it, right? And the way Watford play is different from the way Arsenal play. Mm. Their strikers are different than Arsenal strikers. And John Stones is, I think, objectively, a better option at centre-back than my mate Alexander Kolarov. Why does he die? Is it really like, once you dig past all the BS, these footballers really are just a bunch of superstitious guys who are like, "Ooh, I'm not going to change a team that works."
They'd kept a clean sheet in the previous game, and they hadn't kept a clean sheet for a long time with Stones in the team. And Stones still have been playing poorly.
In a game like this, where you have fewer passers because Fernando is in midfield, wouldn't this have been an obvious game to play Stones? I mean, is there something else? Can anybody offer a better explanation than Pep's, or indeed Ollie's, which is that we kept the clean sheet in the last game?
I think the only explanation is that, you know, he dropped Stones against Watford, I believe, because of the pressure of, you know, Troy Deeney's playing and long boards and this and that, and he didn't want to put him under pressure after the mistakes he made. And then because, like Ollie said, because he didn't concede, because he kind of worked against Watford, he thought, I'm going to keep the same one. And then he changed at half-time, but taking Zabaleta off and bringing Sanya on. So clearly he admitted it was not the best of ideas to keep the same back four. So maybe there is room for Stones as well to come back.
Todd Pep, if you're listening, tweet us, enlighten us. I don't want to get into this thing where we just criticize teams when they lose and he won, and all credit to them for the second half. I just genuinely don't understand how this fits into what he's trying to do.
Well, the issue now is you don't change a winning team, do you? So you leave them out.
Well, that's what I mean, but that's a stupid thing to say. Like, I know people are like that, but there's no evidence that you don't change a winning team. Why? It's just one of those stupid football cliches. You do change a winning team based on the opposition, based on who you have, and whatever else. Maybe Stones was out specifically because Deeney. Maybe he had a knock on Wednesday. And by the way, if there's a guy who changes winning teams and who's changed winning teams all season, it's been Pep. He's done it his entire career. He's changed winning teams. So it's another sort of un-Pep-like move.
By the way, they're away at Hull City for the next game. Do you bring him back for that? Do you keep Otamendi?
You don't change the winning team. All right, Arsene Wenger not happy at all. He blames referee Martin Atkinson, talks about referees being protected like lions in the zoo, which I thought, is that some kind of like French translation? Because I would have thought, you know, there's a better, and lions don't generally need much protecting, kind of look after themselves.
But like protection, it means the cage, yeah?
Yeah.
So, but monkeys are also behind the cage, and so are elephants in a zoo.
So why not
like,
mention? Well,
I know. I don't know.
Okay, so it's not a French
thing. So it's not a French thing.
Maybe
sorry.
It's an Alsatian thing.
Yeah, maybe it's yeah. He's different.
His point was, you can't go near them.
Yeah, and they are.
But
you can't
go near
them. You can't criticize them.
Okay, so.
You can't go near the ref. You can't.
Yeah, I know. But the point is, in a zoo, the cage is there not just for the protection of the lion.
So they don't
eat
you as well.
It's for the protection of the people. Like, if you were to go up to a lion store, I know you're big and strong and athletic, my money would probably be on the lion. What do you think? Assuming you're not armed.
I think you're being very harsh on Mr. Wenger.
Does he have a point, Ollie?
Well, about the offsides, and it's interesting looking at the analysis of the decisions and the various newspapers which have referees as columnists, and
like the Times.
There seemed to be a feeling that there was so little, it was such a marginal decision that you would go with, you know, that you would give the attacker the benefit of the doubt. That seems to be the consensus.
You're talking about the first goal here.
I'm talking about both of them. That seemed to be the interpretation of Keith Hackett and of Graham Poole. I don't think we had Howard Webb in the Times today. But it was those absolutely marginal decisions, and you know, people can look at those freeze frames whichever way they like, because, you know, one guy's facing forward with his arms ahead of him, but if you look at where their feet are, they seem to be pretty much level. It's certainly one where, if you were talking about giving the benefit of the doubt, you would understand why the linesmen had done that. But I mean, you know, the Sterling goal was a different case, but it's but you know, that there's also a sort of benefit of the doubt argument to that one, isn't there?
It's also the fact that was David Silva, was he actually interfering with the opponent, right? Which I'm not sure he was. When they asked Cech about it, he says, well, there were a lot of people standing in front.
He's referring to
the defenders.
Moriart,
yeah, exactly. You know, who are supposed to be standing there.
Makes me laugh, really, because Premier League rules state that you have to come out and speak to the media. You have to do 3 interviews, is it? You have to do the TV. So you get asked, what do you think the referee is? I don't think the referee... Oh, you can't say that. That's a fine. So... you know, look at it from Arsene Wenger's point of view. He's lost the game. I think the first goal is offside, and watching it, I thought, that looks offside to me.
I agree. It was obvious.
You know, and these are so fine margins in the Premier League between winning and losing, and if you actually look and you give the linesman the benefit of the doubt, what I always think is, give him the split second to see it and react. So if you actually give him that benefit, he's even further offside. So, you know, Arsene Wenger's many different reasons by yesterday, but one is that, you know, the linesman has let him down. You know, I think it's offside. I don't even think it's close.
Ozil.
God.
He got absolutely crucified. Ollie, can you explain to us why he was so crucified and whether it's a justification of anything?
Well, his second half performance was poor, undoubtedly, as it had been at Everton on Tuesday night. And it's if you look at the real star players in the Premier League, and you talk about somebody like Hazard, somebody like Aguero, something like Sanchez, those guys seem remarkably adept at dealing with the sort of relentlessness of and physicality of Premier League football and playing week in, week out. Ozil seems to me to have these games where he struggles. I mean, he doesn't look as he looks in need of a break sometimes. He doesn't often get one. He doesn't very often get rotated or rested. But in the present context with him, a slightly fraught state of contract negotiations, I'm sure it will go down a lot. You know, I'm sure it will be interpreted another way. But I don't think it's a guy not trying or not lifting away. I think it's probably a guy who's tired. And would it perhaps have made sense to take him off?
Jules,
in the closing stages?
Should he be rotated more? Is this something? I mean, Arsenal have all this sports science thing. Wenger's been in the game a long time. He's rotated people in the past. I would have thought. I mean, I'm a big Iwobi fan. I think you could do some of the things that Ozil does out there. I mean, you have a bunch of other, even with Ramsey and Cazorla out. Or is this an unfair criticism? You just have to accept the fact that this is the way he is and he's going to have some bad games.
Yeah,
or is he playing badly on purpose, as Ollie said was not the case?
No, of course he didn't. My issue is that it's too often in those big games, especially away from home, where he doesn't seem to fancy it. He doesn't seem to fancy, you know, the pressing. He doesn't seem to fancy the a bit more physicality. He doesn't seem to fancy this. Because when we talked before about why didn't Arsenal do what Leicester and Chelsea did, they could only do it if Ozil had been on a good day, because he was the one to play that ball long into space for, you know, fast run of Iwobi and Walcott and Alexis and all of that. But they played with 10 men. They literally played for, you know,
okay,
first half and second half.
So
whether he's tired.
Does Wenger feel the same way about this, or does Wenger not see it? It's almost like an Arshavin situation.
No,
where
Wenger
plays
on
forever.
Wenger is in awe of Mesut Ozil. And
like he was with...
Yeah, and a lot of people are.
It is Arshavin all over again, isn't it?
Well,
except that Ozil's a lot better.
Yeah, I would say that, probably. And I think he thinks, like Alexis, we cannot win without him. Those big games, I mean, those big games.
But then he doesn't rest them against the fishy teams either.
Either, because he's under pressure to win them.
Do you think he needs different players around him to make him look better? So I look at Arsenal yesterday, and we go back to the keeping the ball. Who actually can get on the ball to give Ozil the ball?
Yeah, but I think Xhaka
can play. If you put him in Chelsea's team with Matic and
Conte
behind him, I think you'd get a lot more out of him. I think you'd have two players there constantly feeding the ball. And I think he's always had his best moments in games where Arsenal are dominating. They've got a lot of possession of the football. I just think a game like yesterday where the team sort of goes missing and they look to their star player, and rightly so, I think there is question marks against him. But I just think if he was in a team that maybe a little bit more, played with a little bit of a higher tempo, a little bit more physical, I think he would be a better player.
Right. Yeah, I do think that Cazorla is a huge help for him in that sense.
Just have him in front.
And when Santi is not there, I think Ozil feels it and it's not working as well.
A word to our sponsors who help bring you the game. One of the more special ones is FanDuel. FanDuel is one day fantasy football. Now, personally, I don't like traditional fantasy football because the scoring is weird and I don't understand that. It seems to only reward attacking players and you have to commit for the whole season and you start badly and you lose interest and whatever else. Well, FanDuel avoids all that because they have a scoring system which actually rewards defensive midfielders, defenders, and so on, and it's on something slightly more meaningful than just whether did they keep a clean sheet. So you actually have to put your mind to it.
they're short contests. It's 1-2 days long, and you're in and you're out. And if you do badly, you start the next one with a clean slate. Now, you can play for free, or you can put your own money in there for a bigger payout. I've entered the £10,000 fan favorite, which only covers the Saturday games. Last week, I did not do too well. That was a £5 entry. I could win £1,000 if you finish first. Again, it wasn't me. The way it works, you have £100 million to spend. There's no subs, no captains, none of that nonsense. Just find the right formation. You go there and you test your football knowledge. They use the Optostats to award points, which is kind of what makes it, in my opinion, rather cool. So you can go to fanduel.co.uk and enter our promo code the game in the promo code field to sign up, and then you get an offer whereby FanDuel will return your entry fee as free credit up to £10 if you don't win cash in your first contest. Now, I honestly and sincerely hope that you do. When I did it on Saturday, I did not do particularly well, partly because I picked Jamie Vardy and then Craig Pawson sent him off. Hopefully, you will have a lot more luck. So it's fanduel.co.uk. You'll find all the details there. And remember our promo code, the game. This is only available in the United Kingdom. And of course, you have to be over the age of 18. Please play responsibly. Term.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Apply. Let's move on to West Brom and United. The Baggies are tough, but I thought United played really well. It looks like things are kind of coming together for the special one, just as Ollie Kay predicted.
I don't think it would take a genius to predict that United's form was going to improve after those sort of difficult first few months. I can't remember how long it took them to win their fourth or fifth game of the season, but it took them an awful long time. They were playing reasonably well, not as well as Mourinho was claiming at some of the time. I mean, he would have had you believe they were Brazil 1970 against Arsenal at home, which they weren't, but they deserved the 3 points. I thought they looked more like a Mourinho team for the first time, really, on Saturday. It was a very, very controlled performance, very sort of physically strong, quite resilient performance with what I would say is a very un-Mourinho-like, unresilient back four. If you look at Valencia, Jones, Rojo and Darmian, if he's made them look like a strong, competent, compact back four, then he's doing well. I think that's been his main achievement so far.
All right, I got to throw this out there. Some of us pointed out that with the way this team is set up, then they need like a Michael Carrick to get the best out of Pogba, not stick him in front of the back four. People are like, well, for $100 million, he should be able to play anywhere. But people who say that are just stupid.
He can play anywhere.
No, I know he can play anywhere. But, I mean, if you want to get your money's worth, you put him in condition. But Michael Carrick is of a certain age, isn't he? Scully, I think your love of United is kind of well-documented. Are you concerned that if Carrick goes or gets hurt, as you were wont to do at his age, that things will just fall apart again?
Michael,
is that
Carrick,
the thought that keeps you up at night? Is that when you wake up with a sheet soaking wet and a freight train running through the middle of your head, thinking of Michael Carrick?
One of many. Michael Carrick has been a massive player for Manchester United ever since he's come here, really. Going back to the Ronaldo days, never got the credit he deserves. Never to think he's only ever won 34 England caps. The Euros last year, he's sitting at home whilst the centre forward is playing in midfield. Is baffling at all.
And Dele Alli. But no,
his form.
So what happens if Carrick? Is there anybody else who can do what Carrick does? Because it's unrealistic to expect Carrick to play every minute of every game, right?
No, he brings a lot of control. So go back to the Arsenal game. Arsenal exactly needed a Michael Carrick yesterday that can take the ball off the back four, that can keep the ball and just get Arsenal back in the game. And the last, I think it's the last 12 games since Carrick's come back in the team, Manchester United 1-10, drawn 2. In the summer, I think Carrick wasn't in Mourinho's plans. If you look at the start of the season, I think he's all of a sudden thought, God, I've got to somehow get the winning formula, and he's come up with Michael Carrick.
The big man, Ibrahimovic. A big bulk of the media in this country and the punditocracy, right, didn't like him. He didn't like him because he was lazy, because he's big, because of the stupid ponytail, because of the weird mannerisms, because of the Route 1. Now he's here. I'm assuming everybody kind of respects at least his ability. Personally, I found him a bit annoying, but he's really, really good, Scully. How difficult is it at 35 to do what he's doing?
It's very, very hard.
You were still playing at 35. How does your body change? And you were, I'm not saying you were Ibrahimovic, but you were also a larger person who was more about skill.
Technically gifted, and I can see the where you're coming from.
You weren't in there for your blistering pace, the way same way Ibrahimovic isn't. You were in there.
He's quicker than what you think.
Okay, he's quicker than you.
Yeah, and you.
Probably. But what I'm saying is, how does your body change when you hit 35?
Well, it slows down, doesn't it? Your metabolism slows down, you change, but I think... You know, this one thing that surprised me, I saw him in a Charity Shield and he did not move. And I thought, this is going to be a disaster for Manchester United because he was so immobile. He seems to have got fitter as the Premier League's gone on. I don't know if there's any facts or you know, I saw him at Palace during the week and I thought he was very, very good. If you look at his run that he makes in the last 5 minutes for the goal, I just think he's so mentally strong. I think that is his strength. I think technically he's very, very good. I think he's a presence, which you need from a number nine, and I think he ticks most roles there. But
what
I would say is the last two or three, you know, he's in his best form, but he did have a run where he was non-existent. You know, if you look at the bigger picture.
The analytics people would say he had a run where he was taking really good shots, high-quality shots, and they weren't going in.
Well, no, he wasn't playing my
statistical
either.
Variance. But can you guys name three players who are more talented
in terms of technical gifts?
In the Premier League right now?
Oh, I don't think there's many, no.
All right, you guys can think about it. You can tell me later.
No, but the thing about it, he might have got fitter, I don't know. But the one thing is that he was very intelligent in the way he realised that he had to change his game because he's not playing the same way as he did at PSG or that he did in Italy before.
How did he play at PSG?
He's running more. He's running more.
What,
he's
now?
Making more effort. His runs are different because at PSG he felt the need of dropping deeper a bit more, or he just liked it because that was his team and he was doing whatever he wanted at PSG, which is not the case at United. Or maybe he just feels that United doesn't need to drop deeper because the players there.
He could also drop and have Cavani cut in from the wing.
True.
One thing
United as well, he feels like there's no need for him to drop deeper because the players who would pass him the ball, like Pogba.
Well, yeah, exactly. So that's the one thing I noticed at Palace on Wednesday night. Him and Pogba had a fantastic connection together.
They're best friends. They are best friends. If people don't know that,
he's clever. With, you know, being 35, he'd have a lot of experience. His movement was fantastic. And every time Pogba got the ball, you know, where are you? And he would look for him. You know, it wouldn't be this, oh, no, pass it 5 yards, sideways, backwards.
But he's a very clever guy, and I think he realised pretty quickly that if he wanted to be a success here, he'd have to change a little bit. Not dramatically. He doesn't run as much as Jamie Vardy, but he had to change a bit. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, for, in a way, adapting himself to the Premier League and not...
I think it's a shame he didn't come 6 or 7 years ago. I mean, we could have seen three or four.
But then maybe at that time he would have behaved differently, because at that time when he was in his prime, he might not have thought as much of, okay, I also need to change, to do something different to be a success here. He probably would have gone in and said, like, I'm going to do my stuff and he's going to work. And he might not have worked at the time.
My concern with United signing Ibrahimovic was this, is that historically, teams on which Ibrahimovic plays play bad football because... the ball just ultimately just goes through him. Either that or they just ignore him the way ended up happening at Barcelona. On top of that, you're not really building anything, because when Ibrahimovic goes, unless you sign Godzilla and teach him how to play football, you're not going to replace Ibrahimovic with somebody similar. You're going to replace him with somebody completely different. United will have to start from scratch. And in those 2 years, whatever Mourinho has built attacking-wise, they're going to have to go back to the drawing board on.
it's been replaced anywhere he's been before, and you know, it worked. And even teams where he left then won the Champions League after he'd gone. So
has PSG replaced him?
Cavani has scored more goals than him.
But those teams that you described changed the way they play.
Yeah,
I mean, Inter Milan changed and won the Champions League after he left.
But why can't United do that once he's gone as well? It's not. It's just you can play in certain way for Ibra.
I think Manchester United will realize. I think they've realized for a little bit now they need a younger centre forward. I still think Martial and Rashford could come through and do it, but I think they're going to have to spend big in the next.
And yet another centre forward. So they're going to have Ibrahimovic, Martial, Rooney.
Carrick and Ibrahimovic are probably going to go. They might get one season out of them both next year, but they need to be replacing it, and they are key players.
Right, moving on. In our debate this week, we're going to make this short and we're going to make it sweet, but it looks as if Oscar is moving from Chelsea to China for an enormous sum of $60 million, I think was a figure we've seen quoted. Ollie, a number of your brethren were kind of disappointed that Oscar is doing this. They didn't stop short of calling him greedy, but they kind of felt that he shouldn't be doing this. I am curious, if you were in Oscar's situation, would you take a pay cut to go play somewhere else? Or would you say, you know what, I'm 25, I'll go for China for a couple of years, I'm still playing for Brazil, this isn't such a bad thing?
I know it's very easy, you know, when we talk about footballers to say, "Oh, what's another million? Why go somewhere for another million?" But you know, I don't know what Oscar's background is, personal background, but it is a short career. The sums on offer in China are so enormous. There are going to be more and more players taking those offers in the same way. And I wrote a column on it on Saturday. If you go back 10, 20 years, it was. The Premier League clubs which were offering, and it probably still is, Premier League clubs which are offering far, far, far more money than is sensible for certain players.
And, you know, I remember when Ravanelli moved to Middlesbrough, people had the exact same reaction.
Ravanelli was one of the cases I was thinking of, because he went there when, you know, at his peak, when Juventus had just won the European Cup, hadn't they? And he was playing for Italy in the Euros. And it was bizarre that he would not just go to Middlesbrough, but it seemed bizarre that he would go to the Premier League at that time. And that is clearly what the Chinese Super League are trying to do. And I think we can all look at it and say these sums are ridiculous. How can you pay Oscar, you know, £400,000 a week or whatever? But we've got to have a bit of self-awareness and say the rest of the world, the rest of Europe, that's what they think of the Premier League.
Anyone who's doing, you know, whatever job, if they're offered five times what they earn somewhere else, even in another country, they will think about it. What's important as well is a lot of other players are offered big, big contracts in China and don't say yes. They don't
like
take
Wayne
them.
Like Rooney, yeah, no, supposedly.
But, yeah, Rooney, but Ibra, many others, some will go, some won't go. I think maybe it's harder for Europeans to go there and, you know, leave what they have in their country or in, you know, in Western Europe, especially to go there. Maybe for Brazilians who by nature leave their country really young to go to Europe, and then maybe for them it's a bit easier in terms of culture and spirit. But if the contract is on the table and you want to take it, right, you can. It doesn't
mean
that. So
nobody's going to go and call him greedy and have a go at him.
Can I ask one question?
Just to finish, you remember we talked about Paulinho not long after the last...
Yeah.
After they beat Argentina 3-0, mm-hmm. We said you can also go to China and still play at a very good level, keeping your level or improving. That's the thing. You
that's
know, you're not,
the key.
You're not suddenly going to play in Thailand where even Scholey could still play.
Can I ask a question? Gav, you might be able to answer it. What can you do with 75 million that you can't do with 50 million?
You know, you were a football player. You know, you always want more money anyway. But it's not just football players.
You get
anyone.
To a level where you think, oh, no, enough's enough.
Right.
But I think he's setting a gamble with his career. Go and do it in 10 years' time. Don't do it now.
Well, do you want a serious answer to your question about 75, 50? He doesn't have 50 million in the bank.
He's not on £500 a week, is he, at Chelsea, where he is? I'm sure he's on a very good contract.
No, he's not. He is on a very good contract. I actually tried to work this out the other day when he went. My guess, and I could be completely wrong on this, and Kia, if you're listening, if you want to text me and tell me, give me better numbers, because I'm guessing he would probably know. I would guess that he has probably earned after tax somewhere between 10 and 12 million pounds, which means that he could probably retire on it and live absurdly well. But since you want to know what you can do with 50 million that you can't do with 10 or 12 million in liquid assets, is you can't take care of an extended family for multiple generations. You can't buy a private plane.
Big yacht.
You can't buy a mega yacht. I'm not saying he wants to do these things, but I can kind of see, like, if in one fell swoop...
But you're talking about his earnings up to now. Still got another up to 10 years playing?
Yeah, but I know. But as you well know, he could snap his leg in two or get hit by a bus or blown up by ISIS, and then that's it. What I do think is going to be critical for him, and what will ultimately decide whether he regrets it or not, is going to be the national team. This is the green and gold. This is 5 World Cups. This matters to them. And whether they're in China or whether they're in the Premier League, I think matters to a relative amount if they can continue to play at a high level for the national side. And he says, do it a couple of years and come back. I don't have a problem with it. Good luck and Godspeed, Oscar. Our beloved George Culkin is waiting on the line. George!
Festive greetings to you.
Thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to have you with us. Now, you wrote a piece in The Game on Monday as part of the Under the Skin of the Game series, where you basically hung out with Sunderland's treatment team. These are the people who help you go and recover. Ultimately, and Skoa, you can tell us if this was your experience, because physiotherapy just takes so long and footballers just sitting there, and unless he's one of those weirdos who wears his Beats by Dre headphones all the time, he ends up talking to the physios, and in some ways they form, it becomes almost like therapy, right?
I think that was the sort of thing that sort of made me want to do the piece in the first place, because I've spoken to physios before and they sort of almost paint themselves as agony uncles, if you like, that and sort of they have probably the most intimate relationships within a football club, because as they sort of say, they see people at their lowest ebb, their darkest moments, and they spend such a huge amount of time with them. So that was sort of something that I wanted to sort of look into and to sort of find out about. But I was also kind of blown away doing it at the Premier League level about just sort of how complex and just so, you know, just how much now goes into that side of things. I mean, you sort of, you know, when you think about a physio, you used to think about a magic sponge and sort of that, you know, that kind of thing, running onto the pitch and that was it, get up, shake yourself off and get on with it. But it's actually such a sort of, it's now such a technological industry and it's so integrated with the rest. And, you know, the old stories about how managers would sort of ignore injured players, that kind of thing. But now everything is integrated and everything's connected. It was reassuring to know that those very deep relationships still exist.
I was struck by one of these guys here is Mike Clegg, who,
yep,
he's a former footballer and he's a contemporary of yours, right? Scully?
Is he the United lad, right back?
Yeah.
Yeah. They come on loan to Ipswich, I've heard of him. Is he a physio now, is he?
Yeah. And he moves on and he reinvents himself in
Good
that role.
Him.
Did he ever different, I mean, did he bring something different to the table when you spoke to him?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, he had sort of Roy Keane and plenty of others, and Gary Neville was ahead of him in the Man United first team, so he's able to kind of relate to footballers in a way that possibly others can't, you know, others who've maybe kind of come from an academic background or purely medical background, and he also suffered injuries. He's able to sort of, you know exactly what they're going through and how it feels, but is also able to use that as a motivational tool. So having played with Roy Keane, can use him as an example. But, you know, if you're having a dark moment, don't feel like doing the work in the gym, you know, he's able to say, well, you know, you do it now, that might mean another year on your career at the end of it. It could be worth this to you, it could be worth that to you, and all that sort of stuff. But sort of also, I was quite interested that his dad is actually the strength and conditioning coach at Man U, or certainly was. So that career was in his family, and he sort of said it's only that side of it, really, that's given him the fulfill. You know, he feels like this should always have been his career, that this is what his career is building up to, as opposed to the playing side.
The other guy that's interesting here, and again, talking about unusual backgrounds, is this this Adrian Lamb guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's the head of performance, okay?
Yeah.
And he was in the Merchant Navy. He worked in forestry. He worked on farms. He drove a van. And this is all before he turned 21. Wait, don't you have child labor laws in the Northeast? I don't... Is he also like a fantasist pulling your leg?
Yeah, he comes from a small village. It's from a farming community. His dad still farms. How you can fit that all in?
But it's such a varied experience that surely that must bring another dimension, I think, to what he does.
Yeah, and, you know, he certainly has. I think they all sort of have experiences of the real world as well, which I suppose must be a very grounding thing, especially sort of within the bubble of football. The sort of level of technology available now is extraordinary. I was sort of, you know, so when players go away, I was shown sort of a player's off-season guidebook. So they have that they get given during the summer, and you see, you know, basic things, what's expected of them. But then they get incredibly personalized sort of exercises to do, specific to them, and it's in booklet form, but of course it's also on tablet form and in their phones and stuff like that. And they get given GPS watches. They're not expected to wear them all the time, but they are expected to exercise, and when they do, that stuff can be accessed remotely and looked at no matter where they are in the world. And I was sort of very impressed by that, how all sort of injured players, their training, their rehab programs are available via sort of touch screens around the building, throughout the building. So there's this, everyone knows what everyone's doing, but at the same time, it is those moments when these guys are alone with players that is when they find out what makes them tick. And it's really that sets the tone for rehab. It's those little relationships, it's those time together. And I don't think that ever has changed or ever can change, and that, I think that's sort of reassuring in some ways.
I love the piece, George, as always. It's brilliant. There's one thing I've never heard in England before since I'm here, is that expression, you are as flat as a fart, which I thought was brilliant. And also, I think, just to continue on your point as well, you can't underestimate the importance of physios in a football club, and I'm sure Scorey would back me up on this one. Even for players who are not injured, who just go for a massage, those physios become almost psychologists. It's just so important that someone like Thiago Silva, for example, brought his own physio to PSG from AC Milan. And a lot of players work like that, and they're so close to the physio, more than the manager, more than other teammates, more than everybody else. And it's even more important when you're injured.
The biggest thing a player has with a physio is trust, because a physio is caught right in the middle. So you're going to spend a lot of time in the afternoons. You might even go for hospital appointments a long way away. I've gone to the opposite end of the country to see a specialist before. You're spending a long, long time with a physio, and you need to gain his trust. And so many times I've seen, it's happened to myself, it happened to other players, where that trust has been let down, where they've reported everything back to the manager. And at the time you think he's his mate, and you realise down the line, you think, well, I'm not quite sure now, you know. And it's a big role in a club, and it, you know, I can understand from the physio's point of view, because ultimately his boss is the manager, it's not the player.
We were going to talk to Gregor Robertson, who watched Gianfranco Zola's debut for Birmingham City. I will now simply, whenever there's a little segment on this, I will defer, because while I know a little bit about Zola, I know very little about the championship, and I make no secret about that. I'm going to start with you, Ollie. But basically, this guy, Gary Rowett, who's a former player, was at Birmingham City. He was seen to be doing very well. The instant reaction on Twitter and social media is like, oh, Rowett was hard done by, and they hired Zola simply because he's a big foreign name. Zola's already worked in the championship. Why was Rowett let go?
Change of owner. There were certain frictions behind the scenes, and a lack of a lack of respect both ways. I think that certainly come out over the last few days. But it's also a classic case of new owners come in. We want something different. We want something a bit more glitzy. We want a big name, and they go for Zola, man with a four-letter name, but a very big name in terms of global football. And
was there an issue too with the fact that they felt that Rowett had been linked to other clubs? Was there an issue too with the fact that they had questions about how committed he would be?
Yeah, because there'd been sort of discussions over a contract, and Rowett hadn't signed the contract, and there'd been interest from other clubs, and I don't think he'd totally discouraged some of that interest. You look at how little expertise there is at boardroom level, in the Championship in particular, where there is this sort of mad hiring and firing culture. And, you know, Zola has come in. To me, Zola is a very, very, you know, well, no, he's not a very, very decent coach. He's a coach with some attributes and some qualities. He's not proven. He's done good job at some places, not so good at others. But I say where he succeeded has been with a certain type of squad, and it's nothing like the Birmingham squad, which is full of sort of free transfer and loan signings from all over Britain. It's not a squad that has the Zola hallmark at all. So I could see him going in and struggling.
Scully, you're familiar with Rowett, and I'm curious, can you just talk a little bit about how he was seen in the game and whether you think, I mean, after an experience like this where he got so much great press, and then he runs into, and I've been dying to say their name, it's called the Trillion Trophy Asia Limited, the new owners. Then these guys came in, they don't like him. If people wanted to sign him before, he'll have no trouble getting a job, right? And it'll be in the Championship, yeah, and maybe with better owners than Trillion Trophy Asian Limited.
Yeah, I think every cloud has a silver lining, doesn't it? And I think he's probably sitting here now, he's in a position of strength where his reputation is still intact. He's a young manager coming through, did a very good job at Burton, gone to Birmingham in a real tough environment, and done well, got them towards the playoffs, really. So sort of overachieved. And I think a lot of clubs now would look at it, if you're looking out there thinking, where's a good up-and-coming young manager? You would look at him, and I think he'll get a good job off the back of it.
One final point on this. Gregor Robertson does a little club guide for everybody. Before you look down, Julie, I'm just going to ask you, how much do you think a pair of binoculars costs in real life?
Well, it depends on the quality. You've got the little ones for the theatre. You've got the big ones if you're hunting or watching birds, something like that.
What's your range for?
I would say between £50 and £100.
Ollie?
I would probably say the same. But I don't know. I get the impression that maybe the ones at the Birmingham Club shop are maybe between,
quid.
Between you, 3 and 5. £4.
You can buy Birmingham City binoculars for just £4 now. Wow. If they're any good, I think that is an absolute steal. Okay, enough of all this fun and games. How about some quick hits? Chelsea make it 11 wins in a row by beating Crystal Palace 1-0. Julian, I think the technical term here is relentless. If you were Conte, would you ask for reinforcements in January, just to be sure? And what kind of positions would you be looking to strengthen?
First, before you put that time thing in, remember the bet? Remember the bet? By the way, two things. I told you Leicester would lose at Bournemouth. I told you too. And you say you're harsh, Julian.
Bosch,
this one,
I'm
just putting this one out there. The other one, I did tell you Chelsea would win the next three matches. Do you remember that one?
Or yes, hasn't happened
well?
Yet.
That's three games since we met that bet.
It's not the third game in Bournemouth.
No, it's three now. It's three. It was two in midweek, and now it's three. So you're going to buy
lunch.
Me lunch. Oh, I'm just thinking where I can go. I'll come back to you on the phone. Just putting this one right there. Anyway, yes, I think they need to buy a defender, a centre-half in January. I don't think Gary Cahill can play on that left.
Zuma!
And Zuma is back, but we don't know at what level. We don't know at what level.
Ivanovic!
Christensen is on loan. Ivanovic is... I won't use rubbish again because that
Nathan Aki.
Put me in trouble. But Nathan Aki is
He's
on loan,
well.
As you know.
But he can come back.
I think they need someone better than that.
I think centre-half is the least of their confirms. I think they're thinking in terms of another centre-forward. And some help in
what,
midfield.
They don't have trust in Batshuayi. It'd be interesting to see without Diego Costa and Conte what they do against Bournemouth. I'm not sure Batshuayi is good enough. And you're right, they might need an upgrade on him. But they paid a lot of money for him and he's still learning.
Meanwhile, it's ugly and getting uglier for Crystal Palace, who have taken 4 of a possible 30 points since October 1st. Ollie, you spoke to Pards. At least that's the impression I got reading your piece. Ooh. He says he'll be having his Christmas dinner, but he won't be tasting the cranberries. Can you translate from South London speak or wherever he's from? He's from South London, right?
I think he is. Yeah. He likes a metaphor or an analogy, Alan Pardew, but this wasn't one. I think he was simply saying that he's going to have his Christmas dinner, and because he's in grim mood at the moment and not in fine spirits, he might not be able to savour the food in the normal way. I think that's the long and short of what he meant. It wasn't a metaphor. Wasn't a reference to the early 90s band called the Cranberries.
Do you have cranberries with turkey anyway?
Yeah,
what's wrong with you, English people?
What's your take on mixing the sweet and savoury? Why? Do you
crazy.
Do that, Ollie?
No, you.
Cranberry sauce, bread sauce, gravy, all of it lashed on, all of it.
You do it too. You put cranberries with your turkey?
No,
okay.
It's
always sensible. What?
You have the full trimmings for
Christmas. No, I don't.
That's so weird.
It's odd to me. Anyway, Tottenham Hotspur overcome Burnley 2-1, but Sean Dyche is furious, believing that Moussa Sissoko, who provided the assist for Danny Rose's winner, should have been sent off for an earlier tackle. Scully, I want to know what you made of the incident.
It's one of those, yeah. You've certainly seen players sent off for that. Just
you're with Dyche.
Over the ball. Yeah, I can see where he's coming from. I've actually been sent off for exactly the same thing at White Hart Lane myself.
Really? And you weren't sent off very often in your career?
3 times.
Well, there you go.
No, 4 times.
He's a relative innocence compared to Sergio Ramos, who I think is 22 and counting.
Oh, is anything Zidane?
Zidane only has 14, I think.
Yeah, come on, find number 10. 14.
Swansea lose to Middlesbrough 3-0, which means more negativity surrounding Uncle Bob, who also got stick in some quarters for using the term PK, one of those Americanisms that seems to annoy so many because it's so difficult to understand what he could possibly mean. His next two home games are West Ham and Bournemouth. If you were Swansea, Julian, and to be fair, you're nearly well, so you're kind of Swansea.
Yeah.
How many points would you say he needs to take out of those two games to be sure of his job?
Oh, I think the pressure is huge. And every time we think that they're doing better, they're playing better, that the whole thing is going, you know, they're making progress, they go back to a horrendous display like the one on Saturday, which was really, really bad. I think he needs 4 points. Well, I guess 2 draws. If they don't lose, it probably that will earn him a bit of time, but the pressure is huge. And as you're almost American, I know you like him. And I like Uncle Bob as well. And the PK made me laugh.
The problem with him is that he went to Princeton, and frankly, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than it is for a person who went to Princeton to be loved by God and good fortune. There are exceptions.
I know, but obviously Princeton is not your favorite.
No. Jamie Vardy gets sent off. Leicester City go 2 goals down, but battle back to make it 2-2. Yet there's plenty of anger at referee Craig Pawson, to the point that Howard Webb himself argues that it's, quote, daft for Pawson to be handed as big a game as Liverpool v City on New Year's Eve, because it's massive, isn't it? Ollie, what do you think? And are you okay with Webb contradicting the almighty PGMOL?
I'm all right with anybody giving their opinion on, as a pundit. I think people are far too sensitive about what pundits think these days. And I've no problem at all with Howard Webb saying that, but I don't particularly agree with it. If he's a Premier League ref, he should be capable of officiating a big game, regardless of whether he's made mistakes in the one before or the two before.
Well, shouldn't the better refs be given the more difficult games? Isn't that kind of a principle?
Should Liverpool-Man City be a difficult one? Do you see it being a real dust-up? I don't. I could see there being lots of offside, very tight offsides, but I don't see it in the most physical or bad-tempered of games. There's only one referee in the Premier League that I wouldn't trust with a game, and I'm not going to name it, but I think he's very poor.
So it's okay for other people to have opinions and go and be critical of refs. Not okay for, but Ollie Kay won't do it himself.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I should name and shame.
Nah.
I'm close.
Jay Rodriguez bags 2 goals as Southampton win 3-1 at Bournemouth. And given the injuries he's had, you can only be happy for him, I think. Scully, how difficult is it to come back from what he's been through? Obviously, you were never out for 2 years, but you had injuries as well at different times.
2 years, it's very difficult. 2 years is a very long time in football. I think most injuries, you look at long-term, a cruciate ligament these days is 6 to 9 months. 2 years is a long time. So fair play to him. I think as a footballer, you have to have the mindset. You just have to keep going, head down, keep going. And you get out of life what you put in. So good luck to the lad. He's obviously worked very, very hard in his rehab. And he was very good yesterday.
You don't get out of life what you put in. You really don't. That's just something we tell people to keep them. The fact is that luck and misfortune can happen, and that
the harder you work, the luckier you get.
I'm very happy for him. And I actually think that if he's close to what he was before, I really liked him as a player. And I thought he actually kind of got the shaft a little bit with England even. I think he's just smarter than a lot of other guys who played for England in that position before he was hurt, obviously.
Gab, one for you. We have a new world champion. Woohoo! It's Real Madrid. But why aren't English people more excited?
Well, that's an age-old thing, because they think this is a stupid tin pot competition, because they didn't grow up with the culture of waking up way early in the morning and being excited to watch this. Because I remember speaking to Stevie Nicol, who told me that about when his Liverpool team went out there to play Flamengo, and it sounded like they kind of got off the plane, drank themselves silly on the trip over, and then lost 4-0 and thought it was hilarious.
That's probably quite true, is it?
Maybe. They probably felt like, well, we know we're better than these guys. Although, to be fair, I think that was Zico's Flamengo.
Yeah,
so,
it was a good Flamengo.
But, look, I think the competition's obviously changed. You have to accept it for what it is. I thought this was a really entertaining game. Kashima Antlers were absolutely fantastic. No fear. In fact, they gave Real Madrid a huge scare. Massive controversial situation with Sergio Ramos, who I thought should have been his second yellow. The referee appeared to go for it, and it appeared as if somebody's in his ear, maybe the video assistant referee, maybe somebody reminding him that, wait, you can't send Sergio Ramos off. As it happened, Ronaldo scores a hat-trick, they win, and we have this wonderful dichotomy where many parts of the world, this is a really big achievement, and it's a big deal. In England, it's not even on television.
First time as well that they were using the video, proper video, not just goal-line technology.
Victor Kasai made a big call earlier in the competition. I think there's more to come on this, and there probably would have been more if Kashima maybe had won this game, or if somebody leaked something about what happened. It certainly was a remarkable incident, and you hope that it wasn't that. It wasn't just somebody reminding him, by the way, he's already been booked. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my guests today. Julian Lawrence, James Scowcroft, Ollie Kay taking time out to speak to us from the beautiful idyllic hamlet of Rippenden, which I'm told is near Halifax, and of course the excellent George Culkin. You can press that subscribe button on wherever you choose to download your podcast, subscribe to The Times, and you can read all our copy. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. We're going to be back next week on a new day, Wednesday. Anybody know why we're on Wednesday? Now Scoey's looking at me dumbfounded. Well, because that's right, there's a holiday called Christmas. The day after that is Boxing. We also got a holiday. So basically, we're looking at next Wednesday. Happy holidays to everybody, whatever it is you celebrate, and we'll be with you soon.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.